our guest today is Anne Liberow. Did I say that correctly?
You did. Well done. Yay. It's actually highly unusual. I live in the world of Anne Libera and Liberia. So that was, I'm well done.
The big question is, are they the same or different people?
Well, I think Anne Libera is a different kind of a girl.
Yeah.
I can't tell you quite how.
Anne is an assistant professor and director of comedy studies at Columbia College Chicago and the Second City in Chicago. She is also the director of pedagogy for the Second Science Project and has presented on improvisation and comedy at the Aspen Ideas Festival, Chicago Ideas Week, and Chicago Humanities Festival. Anne has been a guest lecturer at the Stanford Graduate School of Business. Excitingly, Anne has a book coming out next year called Funnier, A Theory of Comedy with Practical Applications. Welcome, Anne.
Thanks so much. And I should say, I am now an associate professor. I have tenure.
Oh, congratulations.
Thank you very much. So I'm a tenured comedy professor, which is always feels a
little even more special.
Yes.
Yeah, so tell us a bit about what you do at Columbia College.
So I oversee the degree in comedy writing and performance, which is the first degree of its kind in the United States. There are actually several comedy degrees in Great Britain and in, I think there's one in Australia as well.
Oh.
But I created this through my work with Second City and Columbia College Chicago. We created the first degree in comedy writing and performance, and it's At its essence, we are interested in the fact that we find that the really successful comedians in our industry are writer, director, performers who work across mediums. And as a result, the method of training is really what we call comedy cross-training. That if you that even if you're someone who primarily sees themselves as a stand-up comedian, that your ability to write, your ability to act, your ability to think about your jokes in a television show or in on video or online are all the ability to think that way is going to provide for a longer and more useful career. And then ultimately, because we know that not everyone becomes famous as a comedian, it's also a way of understanding, thinking about your work across mediums and thinking about how these containers of comedy can function in different ways, provides our graduates with the ability to apply what we do. And there's a large world of applied improvisation, which I've practiced. We're also sort of talking about applied comedy. When you bring comedy into another space? So that's the kind of essence. And as a result, we think about comedy in a kind of the idea that comedy functions slightly differently in the world, right, than drama.
Yeah.
And really sort of, and that's where this theory of comedy comes from.
Yeah, so what is comedy?
Well, so on a very simple level, I'm going to define laughter is a sound we make, right? But we also laugh for all sorts of reasons that have nothing to do with comedy or humor. We laugh because we're cold. We laugh because someone tickled us. We laugh because we're uncomfortable. We laugh in order to show a superior that they have power over us. Humor is a feeling we have. We literally talk about having a sense of humor. Comedy, then, is intentionally created to evoke laughter or humor in a given audience. And I think that's a really important, when we start thinking about the tools of comedy to use in other settings, one of the things we have to realize is that comedy is relative. What you find funny, the comedy that you enjoy is going to be different from the comedy I enjoy. I'm just going to dive into my comedy theory.
Yes, please.
What I've identified is that there are three sort of essential elements of comedy. And when we create comedy, we use them almost like if you think of faders on a mixing board, right? In order to get a response from our given audience. And those three things are, first of all, recognition. And I used to say truth, but the fact of the matter is that we don't, it would be lovely and very poetic if it was all about truth, but it's really, we laugh because we recognize, we laugh mm-hmm. because we see a character and we think, oh, that's just like my Uncle Dan, right? We recognize the logic of something. Oh, I thought this in a joke. I thought this was this, but it's actually this.
Yeah.
It's all of, and by the way, recognition is one of the ways that you can get comedy on its own. You can put, when Second City used to do companies on Norwegian cruise lines.
Wow.
And very difficult to do comedy on a cruise ship because sort of the mandate of the cruise industry is that no one should ever be uncomfortable or unhappy.
Oh. So
people go on cruises not to have a bad time.
Yes. So you have to tell a different kind of joke.
Yes. And what we discovered is that one of the biggest things that people on cruise ships love is comedy about being on a cruise ship. So we had a whole series of sort of jokes and bits all around things. And the audience was like, yes, I was there. I saw that. Yay. and it's brilliant in that sense of that audience having, oh, we have a mutual shared experience. But we didn't have to do much more than that. So recognition, and again, it's recognition. It can be recognition on a really deep level. This is recognition of a belief, but can it be recognition on a little level? Oh, yeah. I've seen that before. So recognition. The second piece, and this is, if you know anything about traditional humor theory, most of the traditional humor theories that go all the way back to Aristotle and probably before, we've always been asking, why do people laugh? Why do we have this involuntary response, right? Most of the traditional humor theories focus on the second element of my comedy theory, which is pain. Mm-hmm. That we really don't have comedy or humor without some level of discomfort or pain. And that can be pain of superiority, your pain. I'm better than him, or he did that, you know, and that's a sort of traditional clowns. We're laughing at them because they are lower than us. Mm-hmm. That could be the pain of incongruity. Oh, these two things are together, but they don't seem to belong together. That could be the pain of tension. And then release of some kind. So there's Peter McGraw, who's a researcher at the University of Colorado in Boulder, has a theory that all comedy is what he refers to as benign violation. So there's a violation, but it's safer in some way. And that's actually the third element of my comedy theory, which is that, because if it's just recognition and pain, that's it's tragedy. The third element is an element of psychological distance. Mm-hmm. You know, and that could be, and just that distance could be physical. There's a classic Mel Brooks joke, which is comedy is when I cut my finger. Tragedy is when I cut my finger. Comedy is when you fall in an open sewer and die.
Yeah.
So it happens to somebody else, but it could be, you know, they talk about tragedy plus time equals comedy.
Yeah.
Right. So it can be length of time. It can be space, but it's really about the distance that I personally have, or that person I'm making comedy for has on whatever this thing is. And we then use these tools of things like exaggeration. We use tools of absurdity to create, or actually one of my favorite tools that I give my students is, it's funnier if you have a character who does something wrong, it's funnier if they deserve it. Right? So if you set them up to be a jerk, or you set them up to be overconfident, or you set them up to on some level deserve a bad thing to happen to them, then there's that distance that allows us to laugh at them. If they don't deserve it, it's not comedy anymore. So that's the essence. And again, what we do when we create comedy is we get to know who our given audience is. And my audience may be different from yours. My audience, and certainly if you think about the comedy that you like versus the comedy that, say, your parents enjoyed versus the comedy that your least favorite coworker enjoyed, they may be really different. And one of the things that we keep coming up against is that comedy, what is funny is relative. Right. And one of the things I say to my students, we actually spend a fair amount of time talking about comedy ethics, mm-hmm. and how do you choose the kind of comedy you make, and what do you want your comedy to do? Because comedy itself is amoral. It doesn't care whether it makes the people feel good or not. Right? We can be moral. Mm-hmm. We can choose, but I think really useful because there's, as we talk then about humor and talk about using humor in situations outside of expressly written comedy, you know, when you go into a comedy club, you are assuming comedy is going to happen, as opposed to using humor in life or in medicine or in other situations in which we're using it, to understand that's where, when people worry about the dangers of using humor.
Yeah.
Right? They're actually often thinking less about using humor, which to me, again, is a sense of a feeling. Mm-hmm. So humor itself, I think, is not dangerous, but there are levels of dangerous comedy. If I make a joke to you, without really paying attention to all the things that are true for you, that's where those problems come in,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's where it becomes. One of the things we sort of laugh about is that whenever someone writes about, you know, the dangers of humor, they always say when people use humor badly, it's bad. Well, yes. So let's talk about how not to use humor badly.
Yes.
but I think it when we err with humor, when we fail with humor outside, again, of the realm of the comedy club or the plays, and even, you know, to be fair, we fail with humor in comedy clubs all the time.
Yeah.
but when we fail, it's a different kind of failure than it is a failure when we use comedy or humor in life.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Because again, we're touching at some really essential pieces. We're touching at what people believe. We're touching on what people find painful, right? And I can't necessarily know what you believe or what you find painful, even if I assume I do.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah. Oh, we're the same. Oh, well, actually, no. What you don't know is I have a pain in my past. I've had someone in my family who's died of cancer. And so your cancer joke is going to feel drastically different.
Yes.
To me, right? Because of that.
So there's always an inherent risk, I guess, isn't there?
There is. There 100% is. I say to my students actually that we really, one of the things we value in our program is we value risk.
Mm-hmm.
We don't value failure because no one wants to fail. but we value risk, but we also value calculated risk in the same way that, you know, and And, you know, having worked with a number of scientists at the Second Science Project, I often really think that we work very similarly. And when comedians work well, we work remarkably similarly, and that we have an intuition that if I say this thing in this way, I have a theory of the case, right? Mm-hmm. This is my theory. And then I'm going to test that theory in front of multiple audiences. And I'm going to discover whether I was right. So that risk is always going to be part of it. But there are also, and I should really say, I think that there are aspects of comedy and humor that are much less risky. And that one of the dangers of comedy is that people tend to think of comedy as jokes. Mm-hmm. And actually comedy, this would be the other part of my theory, is that comedy really, there's sort of what I refer to for my students is there are five components of comedy. And the first of that is jokes, and jokes are absolutely comedic. They, in fact, are maybe unique to comedy. if it isn't a funny joke, if it isn't a comedic joke, we say it's a sad joke. We modify it, right?
Yeah.
But there's also physical comedy, and I refer to that not just as falling down or slapstick. Although there's some interesting brain research about the fact that the most basic part of our brain responds to slapstick even when we don't understand verbal jokes.
Wow! Yeah,
right. That patients who've had sort of frontal lobe or other issues will not laugh at jokes, but will laugh at slapstick, which is fascinating to me. What I teach with my students, we think about physical comedy as comedy of the senses. And again, if you think about comedy as being recognition, we have all these things, we recognize flavors that are strange or that shouldn't be. So you know, what's the jelly bean game where you taste that? I mean, there's an aspect of that's almost like taste comedy.
Yeah.
Right? I'm expecting something and then I get something different. There's comedy of, you know, what they call ear tickles. When my daughter was young, she had five words that we could say that would just make her burst out laughing. And they were frequent, cubicle, bosom, and tufted headboard.
Wow. That's amazing.
And what's funny about that is that they're not, you know, they're not comedic words other than bosom, which has its own thing. But there's the sound of them is funny. There's this quality to them that is amusing. But you can move beyond that. You can think of all the other senses, the sense of our sense of a body that is moving itself versus a body that is being moved. Right, so there's a lot of old school comedians who would play a drunk character who would then pick their own legs up to walk themselves forward.
Yes,
what's so fascinating about that? That's this kinesthetic. Oh, I know, or a comedy of time. We know how long something is supposed to take. These are all sort of basic things that we understand as people. I want to say too, one of the brilliant things about physical comedy is jokes tend not to travel well. They're due to specific references. You have to know, that this name means in this certain country means something, right? If you had never heard the name Donald Trump,
somehow
a lot of American comedy, maybe not. But physical comedy tends to work across cultures. There's something about human bodies that function somewhat the same. So we've got jokes, we've got physical comedy. There's comedic narrative. and how our sense of being told a funny story and what we expect from a funny story. Mostly we expect a satisfying ending from a funny story. We don't necessarily, it doesn't have to end well. There's the classic Dr. Strangelove, which ends with somebody riding a nuclear bomb. But it has to end in a way that feels satisfying and whole. Okay. So narrative, character, which is similar to physical comedy, it translates, and apparently it translates across centuries. You can look at every culture in the world has a version of a trickster character, a character who sets up a trap and then gets caught in their own trap. AKA Wile E. Coyote from the Roadrunner movies.
Mm-hmm.
Like Coyote is the trickster figure for the indigenous peoples of the Southwest United States. But it's everywhere. It's every culture. From Anansi the spider in Africa, they're in China, they're frequently monkeys. There's every, or if they're a god, so Loki in Norse mythology, they often have animal qualities. All these are comedic characters across the globe, and they have been true for centuries, millennia. There are characters who exist in Aristotle or in the Commedia dell'arte or other places that look very much like characters we see in popular sitcoms. So again, it's that recognition.
Yeah. Does anyone know where this evolved from? Like,
we assume it's, there's no clear, there's some suggestion that laughter itself, the evolution of laughter itself, is based in a sort of fundamental mistake that, I don't know if you're familiar with Danny Kahneman's work about the fast brain and the slow brain, but so to use that terminology, as we developed our giant brains centuries, millennia ago, we automated a lot of processes, but then it became useful evolutionarily speaking to us. Again, this is the theory, I should say, it has not been proven. The suggestion is it became useful evolutionarily to us to check these processes that we automated. So our fast brain jumps to a conclusion, and then our slow brain checks it in some way. And so the suggestion is that humor, this sort of proto-humor, was, I made a mistake, I discovered it wasn't dangerous, or I discovered I was wrong, and I laughed, right? And my brain is filled with positive chemicals, right? That's the sort of place, and that's the suggestion. And Matthew Hurley there's a several people, but I can't remember the other two, have a book called Inside Jokes, which sort of posits this. And I think there's a lot there that makes sense to me. I think what's really interesting to me is I would further say, my assumption is that in some ways that evolutionary element then was accepted in such a way that, oh, if I laugh at something and you laugh at the same time as me, then we have made the same mistake at the same time. So now we have we know that we are each other's people. Right? Yeah. And that's that thing. This is absolutely true. When we laugh together, we get a very warm quality. When someone else laughs at the same time we do, we tend to see them as being connected to us. There's a fair amount. That chunk of it, the idea that we feel closer to people that we laugh with, and that we laugh with people we feel closer to, has actually been studied, and it seems like that's a very common thing. Mm.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah, and it's also, I did mention Donald Trump earlier, it's also the day dangerous thing about laughter, which is that if you laugh, because again, comedy is amoral and it's based on what you recognize, it is not necessarily based on the truth. If you laugh at something with a group of people, it will cause you to believe it more.
Wow.
Right. So it's not a superpower unless you can use it for evil. but yeah, that is the, it's sort of the opposite. And of course it's something that we've formed as small herding humans in small groups, but absolutely. If I hear something and I laugh at it, my brain sort of clocks it as, oh, well, this is true. And it's not necessarily true. It's just, you know, but that's where stereotypes come from, right? Oh, that looks like a thing that I recognize, right? But is it true? Is it useful? That's where it gets complicated. And in fact, to speak to the final, you know, we talked about character, to speak to the final, what I refer to component of comedy is this idea of point of view that, and to be fair, like, I don't know, you know, there's the term dad jokes.
Yes.
Which are jokes that they are jokes that anyone can tell. And for, you know, for the most part, comedians in the first half of the 20th century and before did tell those kinds of jokes. Jokes that were, you know, I could tell it, you could tell it, and now your dad tells it. there was a sort of shift that happened in comedy starting the 1950s, roughly, where we moved from comedy of jokes or sort of overt character to comedy of point of view, where now I'm laughing at a comedian because I feel like their brain speaks to mine. I feel like I'm seeing the world through their eyes. Mm. I feel like, oh, we see the world the same way. You know, and it can be as simple as when I think of the comedian Jerry Seinfeld, and very successful stand-up and his television show in the same way, his comedy is focused on looking at things that we always see, but looking at them like intensely. I'm on a podcast and I'm making finger gestures, looking at tiny things. He will take apart a simple experience of going through an airport and everything is at the ground level. Did you notice this? Did you notice that? And it's hugely powerful because he's speaking the things that you've seen, but you didn't, and you've even noticed, but you didn't know that anyone else noticed. And it's that, and you have this connection, and that's his point of view. He's looking at it from this tiny ground up perspective. There are other comedians whose point of view is just absurd, right? They see the world. Stephen Wright is a comedian. In fact, I love he's got a joke about a one-liner about you going to your house and you pull out your car keys instead of your house keys. Mm-hmm. And he said, you know, and I put them in my door and I drove the house around the block before I realized it. and it's wonderful. It's so absurd. It's got a kind of dream logic. But what's lovely about it is we all have had that experience. And so he's just taking it to this other place. But again, it's that comedy of, I noticed a thing. Here's my point of view on the world. And I'm sharing that with you. And really, in some ways, you know, every behavioral scientist I know has told us that that humans think they're very good at perspective taking, and they're of course terrible at it. We think we know how to read everyone else's brain. Nick Epley, who I've worked with at the University of Chicago, loves to talk about this, and he's done a lot of great work in this. But that we think we know what other people are thinking, and we have no idea. But in a funny way, when we make comedy, we are participating in what I would think of as perspective giving. I'm sort of setting up a set of things for you to see the world from my perspective. And that's very exciting to our brains. We like it a lot.
Well, that's why we read, isn't it? Is to inhabit other perspectives.
Yes. But what is different about comedy in terms of that is that then you sometimes get to do it in a room with other people. So you don't just get to experience someone else's perspective, but you also get to experience that perspective with this, like, in community. You know, when people laugh together, and it's, we often, in my work, because I actually do this thing, I create comedy and I make things and I work with performers to create comedy. And we talk about the difference between, we talk about something called a hard laugh. And a hard laugh is when the entire audience all laughs roughly at the same time, in the same way. And that is magical for the comedian, but it's magical for the audience. Because in that moment, there's very few other times, certainly a little bit in sport, right? When your team hits that, yeah, right? There's very few other times that we get to be in a group and know that we're having roughly the same experience at the same time. And we know because we made that noise. And there's other, you know, we're not all the comedy you make isn't necessarily hard laughs. You can make a, you know, the fun jokes are also the jokes that only like five people get. And they're very and that's one of the things you sort of play for. But that central thing is very powerful. Again, as a reminder of like, we can have these same thoughts at the same time. We do have connection.
And in a performance, do you have to sort of think about spacing those things, or is it 100%. Just?
Yeah. Yes. No, I had a, it's funny. There's certain comedians who are like, I'm just going to get as many laughs as I can. ultimately, that's not a good strategy. I mean, it's a good strategy getting a lot of laughs, but you really do need to sort of give people a chance to have a break and give people a chance to feel a little bit special. And then we do a thing where everybody laughs. I've certainly had to work with comedians where no one wants to hear me say this, where I'm like, get laughs, less laughs.
Right.
Because they're tired. Or yeah. because they need space in between to process what happened. There's a sort of orchestration of that that's almost a sort of back and forth. I'm gonna hit you hard, and then I'm gonna give you a little bit of a break. And ultimately sort of that builds on top of itself.
I think so. One of my favorite movies is Jojo Rabbit.
Yes,
which I think even takes that further. It's like, you know, you laugh and then it goes into this really dark place, and yes. somehow to me those two things make each other bigger and brighter, just being next to each other.
Absolutely. Well, again, remember that pain is a
of course, yeah.
Wrong part of comedy. And so having that pain accessible to you while also giving you the relief of, you know, because that pain is going to create tension for you, but you're giving the relief of psychological distance on that pain. There's, you know, my friend Katie Watson has some stuff about, you know, gallows humor. Which is the humor that we create in order to give ourselves distance on something painful, right? So surgeons in an operating room or soldiers at the front, that darkness, you literally create that humor to give yourself a little bit of psychological distance on this terrible thing that's happening. Mm. You know, and anyone who's had, you know, a tragedy in the family will know that there's times when everyone just laughs so hard. Because it's an escape. I don't think it's an escape. I think it's a kind of new vision on this other feeling you have, and it's a respite.
Yeah, it's giving yourself a little bit of distance that creates a little relief.
Yes.
Or
100%.
So how did you get into all of this?
You know, it's fascinating because I was not a funny child or young adult. I was at a college reunion fairly recently, and I said to everyone, I think we can all agree that I was not funny in college. And they were like, yes. I was a performer. I was interested in directing. And then I got hooked on improvisation. And improvisation is not in and of itself comedic. What it does do, though, improvisational theater in particular, creates recognizable human behavior where people really behave like they behave in life. And that is brilliant for comedy. So improv was sort of my back door into this. I became really fascinated, particularly with the work of Viola Spolin, who was the mother, actually, of one of the founders of the Second City, which is my artistic home, I would say. And I've been here my entire adult life. Every member of my family has worked at the Second City at one point or another, including like my sister and my brother-in-law. I met both of my husbands here. That was really my sort of entry, was being really fascinated by and improvisation as a one of the things I think that is really brilliant about improvisation is that improvisation is a practice. You play the games, and they're based on traditional children's games, but they allow you to practice skills that you can use in your life. It's a practice, you know, I'm an academic and I'm going back to, we're going back into the school year. And of course we're having long retreats about various things. We have, of course, training on diversity and equity and inclusion. But one of the things that's really tough is that you get some of the trainings for this that give you lots of good information. How do you use it? It's very easy to sit and say, oh, of course, but in a highly charged moment, all of that goes away. One of my frustrations, this is not recently, but one of my frustrations with some of that training is that they're like, oh, well, you'll role play. But actually role playing is not, one of the things about improvisation training as we practice it in Spolin training is that you are yourself.
Mm.
You are honestly yourself, and therefore you have these responses honestly. And that is what allows you to practice a new behavior. So I'll use an example from the Second Science Project of an exercise that we developed. And it's funny, as we were working the Second Science Project in particular, we're thinking about how to give people experiences that behavioral scientists can use to test theory. And then also create experiences that allow people to practice the insights of behavioral science. And we created an exercise Xuan Zhao, who is is now at Stanford, who is a postdoc on the program, is working on a paper about this particular exercise. For the exercise, we wanted a situation in which two people were genuinely at odds. We were in genuine disagreement. And how to have a conversation with someone when we are genuinely on opposite sides. So we came up with an exercise prompt. The prompt is that if you and I are having an argument, the prompt, which is thank you because, and some of this is based on Nick Epley's work on gratitude. There's actually a fairly big, we tend not to anticipate that other people will see our gratitude as valuable, but we really do. We're very driven by gratitude. So you have to genuinely listen for something in the other, what the other person is saying that you are grateful for. And you say, thank you, because, and you tell them what you're grateful for. And then you go on to say whatever you want to say. You do not have to agree with them. But you do need to listen for something that is valuable to you. And what we discovered is that that exercise genuinely promotes warmer interactions. People have, and they may or may not get to, again, this is the whole point of this, is that it's not about coming to agreement necessarily. It's about having better versions of those conversations when you're on different sides of an issue.
And promoting listening.
Oh, 100%. It's promoting listening, but it's promoting listening plus I'm not just listening. I'm recognizing and reflecting.
Yeah.
Right. So and certainly when we talk about versions of active listening, some of those things are also involved. There's a couple of interesting things about this. First of all, to go back, when we were creating it, we had to find ways to get people into actual points of disagreement. We couldn't say pretend to be this. If we did that, it didn't work at all. So what we did was find a bunch of things like crunchy versus smooth peanut butter, or other which way the toilet paper goes. People feel very strongly about that, by the way.
Yes.
and when we first proposed it, all the scientists were like, "Why? No one cares about that." I'm like, "Just wait." Something that they could genuinely argue for and really, but still be in that conversation. One of the things we found, there are a couple interesting things. One is at a certain point early on, as we were developing this exercise, we started, a number of my colleagues, we were starting to think, oh, maybe this is disingenuous. You know, you could say thank you because, and be snotty about it. And then we discovered that we're using it on each other when we were having arguments about things.
Oh, that's fantastic.
But one of the things we discovered too is that we did a set of follow-up that where the question was, would it work if just one person did it? And it turns out it does. It decreases the heat and it creates more connection.
My husband is never going to listen to this podcast now, because this is my secret, my secret weapon.
It's a great little superpower.
Yeah. Oh, that's brilliant. So then did you do a comedy degree of some kind before you went into research, or?
There weren't any.
No.
I got my undergraduate theater degree at Northwestern University. So okay. I have a theater background, and then went on to study. But I couldn't do it because it didn't exist.
So you had to help make it exist.
Yeah, exactly. But I had run Second Cities. I was the executive artistic director for Second Cities training centers, which include both improvisation and comedy. And this was when I started to become really interested in, okay, what's this deeper thing that we can do with this? What else? You know, yes, I love improvisation, but there's this, and it turns out, because I have a very mathematical and logical mind, comedy is fun for me. That's that recognition thing. So it built on itself.
For those of us who live overseas, could you talk a little bit about Second City?
Sure. Second City is a improvisation comedy theater that started in 1959. It started in Chicago. We do have another location in Toronto, and we've had locations in a variety of places. The Second City uses improvisation to create sketch comedy, and has had over the years many, many famous alumni, including Mike Myers, Mike Nichols and Elaine May, Tina Fey, Stephen Colbert, who, by the way, was my roommate in college, and I got him a job at Second City. I made him take classes, and the rest is history. Steve Carell, Kikumago Ki, Jordan Peele was a student here. The list goes on. And even Steven Yeun, who was in The Walking Dead and initially is in Jordan's new movie, was a student here. So we're very lucky to have this, and of course all the original Saturday Night Live performers, John Belushi, Gilda Radner. So it's this amazing place to where we get to create the work we create when we create our reviews here. We do it in front of an audience. We have a show going on, and then after the show, we have what we call an improv set, and the audience stays, or they can go, and new people can come in. After every show, or almost every show, not the late night Friday show, but this happens, and as a result. And the founders of Second City were very social justice warrior types. They were really interested in creating comedy that spoke to people. And what we have is this opportunity every single night to have that conversation with that audience in the room and see what they like and what they don't and what interests them and what doesn't and what they care about and what they find funny, what they recognize, what do they find painful. I think there's a real reason why these performers have gone on to do amazing comedy of all kinds, and sometimes not, even dramatic work, is that there's this absolute understanding of how they get that opportunity to be in front of that audience and have that experience of that conversation. Right. And then you can go, and then it becomes much easier to turn it into a movie or a television show, right? Because you have their voice in your head.
Mm-hmm. And is there like a point of reflection that happens after that? Or yes. Do you talk it out as a...
Yes. So the improv set is every night. So sometimes the actors just improvise for fun. When we're in process of creating a new review, there is a director. The director is paying attention to what's happening. The director sort of says, "Oh, this was interesting. Maybe we should explore that a little bit." Eventually, we have an existing show. We'll take little bits out and put new pieces in, and get a sense of what they like and what they don't like. Our performers are very skilled. So it's always, even though something's in process, the audience doesn't necessarily know. So eventually we have a new show that really speaks to, and again, what I think is really interesting. So this current, our most recent show that's playing right now called Do the Right Thing and If Not, No Worries. Is fascinating because it's really the first full show that we've done post-pandemic. And so it really reflects where our audiences are in terms of what's too painful for them. There's a lot that's fascinating to me. There is a lot that's too painful for people right now. Even things that aren't related to the pandemic, it's like we're all a little bit raw. Right. But it's that building that in front of them allows us to have that moment of like, okay, what works for you? What doesn't work? Oh, okay. That's too painful. Oh, but this feels good. Right. And that's, and you know, within that there's realms of social criticism, there's elements of satire, and because we're a little bit lefty, we want to change the world through comedy. But it's that piece of sort of saying, but our audiences are very much people who are like tourists who know that Second City is famous and
come.
You know, they just come. There's a Simpsons episode where Homer Simpsons goes to the Second City, and the headline on the thing says, "Come see the famous comedians before they get fat." But that's actually brilliant for us because we're not speaking to ourselves. Right? We're saying you are people from all over. You don't know, you have no idea what you're coming to. Now talk to us about what you like. Talk to us what you care about. Talk to us about what's recognizable to you and what's painful to you and what you feel safe laughing at.
It really feels like politicians should have a bunch of comedians that work with them.
Well, they do sometimes, actually. Yeah. It's not unusual that politicians. The problem is that there's a certain kind of the difference is wanting to be liked versus wanting to make somebody laugh. Politicians don't want to make anyone uncomfortable.
That's true.
So they may have comedians with them, because a lot of speechwriters are frustrated comedians.
That makes so much sense, actually.
Yes. Well, and like Obama was very funny. Obama had a whole, could deliver a joke very well.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, and to be fair, Donald Trump has the cadence of a stand-up. He sounds like a comedian, which again is part of that. Okay, that isn't that interesting.
Isn't that true? I don't want to keep you too long. I've really enjoyed chatting with you today, Anne. It's been a privilege to have you on Science Right Now.
Thank you so much. It was absolutely my pleasure.
Thank you.
Science Right Now is sponsored by the Australia Council for the Arts, hosted by Amanda Niehaus and Jessica White, and produced by Taylor Mitchell. Thanks so much for listening.